But we won't. Oh. You can talk to her.
Okay.
And here she.
Okay. Okay, can you hear me now? Is she still on hold?
She's supposed to be.
Oh, can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
Okay, I'm still picking up static, but what do you think?
Oh, I think that's the. I don't know why they don't have any.
I can try putting my headset in. But at least
No, I think you don't need to do that. Let me try this. And if it's going to not work, then I'll just jump in my car and I'll come over and see you.
Okay.
I was trying to be more efficient. Okay. Can you still hear me now?
I can.
Cool. And now I don't hear the static anymore. Okay.
Okay.
So that's good.
Okay. We'll just keep
working. Right. Good.
Okay. Are you ready, my friend?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Carla.
Okay.
Oh, I better hit the record button, huh?
Oh, it's recording.
Okay, great.
So, and then here, if you want to turn her down, you turn her down here. If you want to turn you down, turn it down here.
Okay, perfect.
And then, you know, you can save it in the usual places.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much.
Yeah. I'd have to find out how those other ones work.
Okay, I appreciate you. Thank you. Okay, Juanita, you're still good?
Yep, I'm still good.
Okay, do your best. I wonder if there's a way to, this is so funny, the studio, we have all this new equipment that nobody knows how to use. Anyways, so my DIY mama piece got accepted, and so I'm including you, a woman who came to the country through, like, arranged marriage and, like, was from a lower caste than her husband and went through all kinds of stuff with that. I even got Echo to talk because of, you know, her different socioeconomic start point. But I was thinking about your story, if you're willing, we could talk about what your life looked like before having children a little bit, and then even like your first marriage, if you feel comfortable to talk about, you know, kind of the aloneness part of what that was like. I feel like when we talked, you sometimes felt like you were a single parent, even though you were married, right?
Oh, yeah, no, most definitely.
So I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions. And if there's anything you don't want to talk about, just tell me. And, you know, we'll just go from there.
Okay.
Okay, cool. So I'm going to have you start by telling, like, say who you are, like what your name is. You're a mother of two. You're a teacher. Kind of just a general introduction to you.
So my name is Juanita Abundas. I'm a mother of two children. One is 9 and the other is almost 2. Their names are Sai and Nico, and I teach high school science for a living.
And I happened to meet you when we were both in the same village in Indonesia in 2009. And I know that your life changed drastically after children became a part of it. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely a huge life-changing experience in many ways. I went from, you know, doing my thing, working and traveling, meeting people, going out and doing different things. And then I met someone wasn't quite sure, but we got a surprise and we were going to have a child. And that kind of turned everything around. I knew I wanted to be a mom as soon as I discovered I was pregnant. I had always kind of been a little on, you know, back and forth about it. Like, oh, that's something I'll do in the future. And yeah, every aspect of my life changed because suddenly it revolved around this little person that, you know, I had to take care of and nurture and find her people that could watch her while I worked and all of these different things. But also, I mean, it changed me as a person and my focus. Just watching her grow and develop became just such a joy. And some of those things that I used to do before, you know, they were still interesting, they were still fun, but they didn't have quite the appeal that she did. So they definitely lost that. And my focus became mom. Are you still there? Hello? Did we get cut off? Did you lose me? Hello? Hello, hello.
Juanita?
Yeah, okay.
Oh my God, that's so funny. I was just talking to no one. Okay.
Yeah, no, because again, it was completely cut off.
I've been silencing my mic and then I pulled up the wrong mic, so I'll fix that. Okay. Sorry about that. So I was saying it's serendipitous that I'm interviewing you from KPFA right now because this was back in 2009 and I was here for a shift. Or was it 2010 when you found out you were pregnant?
2010, yes. It was 2010.
Okay.
When I came there.
And we met next in the little, in Udupi Palace, and you were telling me that you might have the surprise and you weren't sure. We went and bought a bunch of pregnancy tests. And talk about that kind of defining moment and how, I don't know if you had a different kind of, like if you imagined motherhood in a different context, if it was going to happen for you. Like some people have this narrative that involves like, they're going to be married and it's going to be this perfect kind of planned out thing. So what was your kind of idea about motherhood and how did that contrast with reality or how you got thrust into it?
Yeah, I mean, my idea of motherhood was it was something I would plan for, be prepared for, have found a stable, committed partner relationship. We've been together for a while, and that was something we both wanted, and I would have had everything financially and, you know, a nursery set. I don't know. I mean, just, I guess, some of the typical things that you see advertised about planning to have a child. Yeah, that was in my mind. It was just so on the back seat, I guess, that or so far in the future that I wasn't really giving it much thought. So when it happened, and, you know, I was living with some really close friends and we shared a house and, you know, I had a room in that house, but my life was not at all what I thought it was going to be. And I was dating this guy who I liked, but was starting to get the idea or the impression that maybe we weren't the best fit. When we discovered that, yeah, we were having this child. So it was an immediate switch of modes to, my gosh, I guess it's the typical nesting that women go through. I need to have, I got to either live with this guy or we've got to find a place that has that's fit for kid. You know, what do? Do I raise it on my own or do I stay with him? And there were pros and cons for both. In the end, I think I chose just because it was kind of what society dictates. Yeah, let's make it work. You got to make it work because you'd have to have two parents. They have to live together. So I followed that path. And yeah.
You got married, right? And do you want to talk about kind of like the path that, like, what it looked like for you, like, how long you waited to get married and when that happened, and kind of, you know, give us a little picture of what your life looked like and what it looked like as you started. Like, you basically got to know this, your husband, as you lived with him, right?
I did. You know, we had known each other from before we rock climbed together when we started dating for a while, but I didn't know him. You know, I really didn't know him very well. And when he found out, you know, he wanted to do the whole marriage thing. And I was the one who was on the fence. Like, I don't know if I want to do this. In the end, I did. I actually, at the time, this was back before healthcare changed, when, you know, I didn't have maternity on my healthcare. So I had to get married in order to change that, to change my status, so I could get healthcare that had maternity coverage. Or prenatal care, because I had a pre-existing condition. So that kind of forced my hand a little bit. I found out I was pregnant in March, and I got married in June. So it was pretty fast.
And baby was born in November.
And she was born in November. And in about July is when I moved out of my place with my friends that I was living with and moved in with him. So there was that. And there was a lot that went into that. At the time, he'd been living with his sister. So she had to find her own place. And there was, you know, some drama around that. And then moving in with him, I found out he was very possessive and controlling of his stuff. So there wasn't a lot of space for me and baby, because I was moving into his world and his space. So that was different, because I always valued my freedom and ability to choose. He was raised in a very different society, I guess you could say, than me. He was raised in a small Midwestern, like, farming town. So it just, you know, the perspectives were very different from the Bay Area, California girl. So yeah, I got to know him, and while there were aspects that were interesting and I enjoyed, there were also a lot that were surprising. For one, I did everything. He really wasn't involved. He was always working. I guess in his mind, he was running his own script of, my job is to work, my job is to work, my job is to work, even though I had the more stable job and made more money and contributed more financially, he still spent all of his time working. So that meant I did all the housework and taking care of the baby and basically all the parenting. It's like I became a single parent. I just lived with someone who, you know,
and earlier
was home, but they were, again, always working until they fell asleep. So it was a very interesting relationship.
And earlier you were talking about space and the way that people possess space. And before this, you were very kind of free-spirited, travel the world during your summer vacation, do whatever you want in the summer, go wherever you know, take a dance class, travel. And then you teach during the, you know, academic year. And then in your home, would you like to talk about the man cave and what was supposed to be your designated area and how these kinds of things impacted your relationship?
Yeah. When we lived in San Francisco, we had a two-bedroom house, but one room was just exclusively his. And finally, when we left the city, because I couldn't handle the commute anymore, we moved closer to my work. And the caveat was that if we got a two-bedroom again, one of those rooms would be his and his exclusively. And that was, you know, the only way that he would move and leave San Francisco or the city. So that was really hard for me, because he would close himself off in that room every day and do his thing, and or bring his friends over and they go into that room, and like literally it became the man cave. And his family would come to visit a lot, and they just stay with us for weeks and weeks. He did have a sister, or he does have a sister that was an alcoholic, and she'd come stay too. And there was a lot that went on with trying to deal with that. I kind of have to walk on eggshells in my own place. Like, where do I go? I mean, I have these people staying in my living room. He's in his man cave. The baby's in our bedroom.
Because, and where again, was your space? Where was your space in your home?
He said my space was the kitchen. So I did like to cook, granted. It was hard because I never really had a place to call my own, and I need that, kind of a little place that I can just recoup and rejuvenate. So that pretty much led to the breakup of our marriage. We saw counselors. We tried to work things out, but ultimately it was the disregard for everything I do and the disregard for my need for space, the disregard for my need for input. Like, I need to know if your family is going to come stay with us. It's something you ask me first. You don't just invite them to stay indefinitely without really talking to me about it. And, we can't have multiple people here for long periods of time that have substance abuse problems. It just doesn't work that way. So I was the one who had to set his family straight as far as what I allow and what I can't allow, because it's not healthy. That put a lot of risks in our relationship, and we eventually filed for divorce. He moved out and found his own place, but it was a long process transition because he'd never taken care of our daughter, and he had no clue. And she was still pretty young, 3 and 4 years old, and he never made her a lunch or combed her hair. So he had a lot of learning to do, I had to train him in. And so it was a very slow transition of being fully out of the house and having her half the time.
So not until the breakup of your marriage does he really step up as a parent.
Yeah. And then he finally did. And he really did. And, he still does a lot of things that I question. She's had her clothes on for 2 days straight and just slept in them. That's so sweet. Her hair could be combed. But he does try. And they do have a really good relationship. And he and I have become very good friends since our separation. Actually, he helps me more now than he did back then. So, in the end, it's an interesting experience.
Yeah.
We learned a lot about people and each other.
Yeah. So. And I'm wondering, do you remember, and of course I can edit out any of this, and this, I wouldn't have such a thorough interview if I didn't have a personal relationship with you, but something that's striking me is that when you were struggling with issues in your marriage, like, I remember you really looking at yourself and thinking about, what is it about me or my mental health or what might be going on with me that's causing this? Mm-hmm. Do you remember that process? And yeah, because I think this is something that happens to women a lot when the marriage might be falling apart or their relationship or there's a problem. I think it's very easy for people to point toward the women and say, well, what might be going on for you? Why are you not okay? So I was curious about your take on that.
Yeah. I mean, there's always that self-judgment that can go on easy. It's everywhere. There's so much pressure, I think, as a woman to be the best at everything. You got to be the best at work because you got a lot to prove. You've got to be the best mom. You've got to be the best wife or, daughter or whatever it happens to be. There's a lot of that kind of pressure. And of course, when my marriage wasn't working, I, was reflecting on it. It's like, okay, what have I done wrong? Am I just too difficult to live with? Are my demands unreasonable? And again, in the moment, it was like, no, these seem pretty basic. Like, can I just have one Saturday morning off to go hang out with some of my friends while you watch our child so that I can feel rejuvenated too? I didn't think that that was a huge demand, since he took every weekend to himself pretty much. So it was little things. But, yeah, you can't help but question, well, was that too much? You know, I think, again, as women in society, we've been trained to, how do we make men comfortable? And I finally got to the point, now, how do I make myself comfortable? Because I'm taking on so much, and I'm working so hard, and I really am trying my best. I think it is worthwhile that, you know, he step up too. We changed kind of the paradigm of how we've been taught to behave in relationships and in family, because that was the only thing that really would have saved us in our marriage.
Thank you for sharing that and for talking about the how do I make myself comfortable as opposed to what can I do to comfort this other person. I think that's really worthwhile to point out, especially during International Women's Day, as this as the work that's done at home is largely done by women. And I think your story is so, it's really, really compelling, right? It takes like a divorce in order to get help with your child. And I wondered if you could project us ahead a little bit to talk about when you became a mom for the second time. And I know, because I have a personal friendship with you, I know that this situation was night and day different in the way that you approached it and societal expectations and what you thought about them. So maybe walk us through that piece a little bit, if you're willing.
Yeah. You know, after separating from my daughter's father, she was only 4 at the time. I had to learn to, you know, do everything on my own. But actually, my life got a lot easier because then I had somebody who had her half time. So I had all this time to really develop myself. And I did a lot of wonderful things, painted, danced, yoga, retreats, more travel. However, through it all, I did realize I wanted another child. And again, I was faced with the reality of, okay, I don't have a relationship. I'm nowhere near having a relationship. I've been on a lot of failed first dates, and that's pretty much the extent of my dating life. And it was something that I just figured wouldn't happen. But then the thought started to cross my mind, well, I've already been a single parent before, and I did really good, and I'm doing it right now. I could do that again, you know, and it was the thought that kind of came and went, but, you know, I kind of put it on the back burner and went about my life, and I got kind of a surprise when I discovered that after a, you know, interesting, very short-lived relationship with somebody while I was doing some investing and travels, I was pregnant. So that thought that I had originally had all those years about wanting another child and thinking, could I do it on my own, came back. And I start asking myself, okay, I wanted a child. What's stopping me? Do I have the time? Yeah, I do. Do I have the money to take care of this child? Yeah, I do. Is this something I want to do? I'm like, yeah, I do. So that's how I became a mom a second time, completely on my own, which the ironic part is I wasn't actually completely on my own, because my daughter's father actually really stepped up to support the whole process and was even at the hospital when, you know, my son was born, and has been, you know, big part of his life to the point where he's so far the only person I've trusted to watch him overnight so that I can have some time to myself. And so it's been an interesting journey. And this time around, you know, at first I was a little hesitant, like, I'm going to go through pregnancy and delivery all on my own. But actually, it was really nice, because the first time I did it, there was a lot of stress. I was in a new relationship, getting to know it. I didn't know what to expect. I'd never been pregnant before. And this time around, I knew what to expect. I did what felt right for me. I had plenty of time to rest because I had so much time to myself. I already had my life and everything established. And it was empowering in a way. And after he was born, I had tons of friends and family that were there that helped. And just being able to really bond with him. And, you know, again, I had no really major stressors to worry about. It was just me, him, and my daughter. And that was great. It was the three of us. And it's still, to this day, the three of us. We have a wonderful time. Yeah, there's moments where we're tired, but we all kind of pull together. I mean, my daughter is pretty incredible with watching him and helping out with him. So their big age gap, you know, she's 9 and he's 21 months. So, yeah, I mean, she really can step up and help out. And then we just all have a great time hanging out together. So
okay,
learning
I'm gonna
together
go in for
teaching each other.
Thank you so much. I'm going to go in for a juicier question, and you can, you know, answer in whichever way that you're comfortable. But I wondered, would you be comfortable just kind of like telling the story about, like, you know, kind of what you were doing? From what I remember that you shared with me, like, you were kind of on a journey of self-rediscovery, and you were in a new kind of mini relationship. And if you're comfortable sharing that and kind of how you decided that this time you're, you know, like, it's not practical to have this child with the father, or, you know, like, you were going to do it on your own, would you be comfortable to kind of like just give a couple of concrete details to draw a picture of what that decision looked like for you in
the
process?
The person who I ended up that I was with, and again, it was a relationship that I knew at the time that I did not want as anything, you know, long-term or serious. It was just kind of where it happened based on spending time together and working on some of the things that we were working on with this project. But right away, when I knew I was pregnant, there was the very first thing was, no, there is no way. I've done this before. I'm not making that mistake again. I'm not going to raise this child with the father. I'm not going to be with somebody just because I'm having a child and it happens to be their biological child. And this person was in no place to even step up to be that person. So,
and he was being together would have required some creativity, right? Because he was out of the country.
Yeah. And again, it was international. So, yeah, it was like, there's no way I'm going there. Mm-mm. I have my family, my daughter, my life up here. And there's no way you're coming with me because I don't want to be with you in that way. And I definitely don't want to raise a child with you. Because, again, some of the big red flags I learned the first time around, overt need to control, you know, a view of a woman's job and a woman's place is in the home and doing things to take care of it. And the man really doesn't have that role. I'm like, no, I'm not going to fall into that again. This time, again, it's all on my own. And yeah, so it was good that I could identify that right away. I mean, that need to, you know, make it work. It was like, no, actually, it makes it worse. Because to have two people that should not be together try to force the relationship is not good for children. And I know it's really, I watched my daughter go through a lot of pain because having us together the short time that we did made it really hard for her to have us apart. And even though it was better for her, and she agreed that we are much better separately, except she's the one who's sad all the time. Because she always has to be without one of us. And I didn't want him to have to go through that. Plus, I didn't think that individual was a good role model for, you know, my son. So knowing that I could do it on my own, and that he would have a really good life and he'd have plenty of family and friends to support him. No, I just made the choice. So,
Thank you. And so you had your first child at the age of 28 and your second one at the age of 37. You did the first time around a more conventional model where you, you know, got married in an attempt to have the traditional or quote unquote traditional scenario, and second time really didn't worry too much about that. Something that strikes me is the number of women that I'll encounter, or actually even people who would be grandparents, and I, you know, if they're talking about children, they'll say like, oh, I don't have any grandchildren. My child's not married, or I'm not married. I don't have any kids. Or I've also encountered some women who really would like to be mothers, but haven't met the person and can't imagine a scenario where they're doing it alone. They don't want to go against the grain of the societal narrative, I think. What would you say to, for example, a woman who'd really like to be a mother but feels that she can't because she hasn't achieved the other things, such as marriage? And I'm going to say achieved in air quotes. What might you say, or what might be some counterpoints you might ask someone like that to think about?
Well, I mean, for me, having a child is the best thing I've ever done. I love my children, and I've done a lot of cool things, so they're by far the best thing I've ever done. And the thought of not having them is just, no, I wouldn't trade them. And the thing is, I mean, relationships, even the best relationships with a partner, they come and go. People change, especially in this day and age. You know, we live long lives, and, you know, there's very few people that have the same partner the whole way through. And it's sad to see some women who really want to be mothers and really, really, really want to just not do that and forgo that opportunity simply because they're waiting for the right person to come along. You know, I mean, just do it. If you feel that you are capable, you have the energy financially, I mean, the world is run on single mothers now. There's more single mothers than there are non-single mothers. And, you know, women traditionally have always been the ones primarily raising the children. And it's not easy all the time, but then being a mother never is. I mean, I know plenty of mothers that are stay-at-home moms, that have a husband that works or a partner that works, and they just get to be with the kids all day, that still are exhausted and tired and have all that. At least for me, you know, I'm in charge of my life. I get to choose what I want to do and how I'm going to raise my children and what we're going to do together. I mean, I take my kids with me everywhere. We travel the world, and we've been all over the place. And I don't have to, you know, arrange that with someone else and make sure that they're on board and they want to do it this way or that way. And two, they get to see what a strong woman looks like. And that's a beautiful thing, because, you know, that's something I want my daughter to know, that she can. And this is how you do it, you know, one day at a time. And you just, you know, it's not something where I'm sitting here waiting to find the partner who's going to save me from my single parent. No, it's, I love being a single parent. This is who I am. If I find someone, great. If I don't, that's fine. I'm happy. So, you know, think about that. Embrace that. Ask yourselves those questions, because that's the key thing. If you want to have children, ask yourself those questions. And do I have the time? Do I have the desire? Am I financially capable of taking care of this child? And if all those answers are yes, and you have a community that will support you, go for it, you know, or make changes to make those things happen and put those things in place. It's not as bad as it's made out to be at all. In fact, kind of liberating.
I love it. Okay. I'm going to talk to you about your own mother in a minute, if you're okay with, like, kind of your own narrative, your story about the mother you knew growing up, and then your connection in later life with your birth mother. Again, with the preface that you can say, I don't want to talk about that, and we just won't. But I wondered if you could take us to the birth room and talk us through what you remember about the day that you brought your second child into the world, which was probably very different. I mean, you could even do a comparison of the two if you'd like to, but what do you remember about the birthing process?
Oh, well, the first time I was scared. I really was. I remember I had to be induced because she was so late and they'd scheduled the induction that day at 2, and I was in my room, didn't want to go. And Saya's dad actually had to talk me out because I was crying. I was just like, I don't want to do this. Because there is, you don't know what to expect. That's something, unfortunately, in our society, we don't learn a lot about is birth and or death. So, unfortunately, being induced was not good. My labor was very long. It was 44 hours, and I chose not to have any pain aids or pain medication during that time. So it was very tiring. That being said, because I didn't choose any pain medication, when it was over, it was over. And it was great. And I could get up, I could walk around, and it was Thanksgiving Day, so we had Thanksgiving in the hospital. So it all worked out. But I learned very quickly why they call it labor, because that's what it was. So there was a lot of hesitancy there in having a second child. So when I was pregnant the second time, I had done lots and lots of yoga. Lots and lots of yoga in between and lots of different meditative practices. So I was more in tune with my body, plus I knew what to expect. So this time, he was late too, but I knew exactly when I was going into labor. And I was very calm about it.
And what did that day look like?
What was that?
Take us to that day when you were going into labor the second time around.
So my mom was visiting because she knew the baby was going to come soon. And we had gone for a walk that day, pretty long walk, like 5 miles around the neighborhood, just talking, chatting. Came home, ate food, went to bed. And at 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning, I woke up and knew I was in labor. I was getting these contractions, and I knew what they were because, again, I've been in labor before. And the spacing, the timing, and I just knew. I had a dream about this little boy talking to me, which I guess was my son, and woke up and was like, I just knew. It's time. He's ready. So I calmly got up, got dressed, packed up whatever I needed to, and had everything ready by the door before I woke up my mom, who, of course, when I said, yeah, I'm in labor, it's time to go to the hospital, she was in a kind of a crazy panic. I wasn't. I was perfectly calm. So we get to the hospital, and they're like, okay, you're about 4 centimeters, and, you know, just walk it out. So that was about 6 in the morning when we got there, and yeah, that's what I did. I just kind of walked around the hospital in, you know, little contractions. They weren't painful. They were pressure, but again, I knew what they were. I knew what to expect, and I think not having that fear took away the pain that's usually there, because I think a lot of that pain is when you kind of tighten up your whole body, like you flex your muscles against it, and that's what hurts. If you just kind of let it happen naturally, it's not pain, it's more of this pressure. So by the time they checked me in and got me into the room, everybody was there. My mom, my really good friend, Sai's, my daughter's father, and my daughter. And they'd set up a party. I mean, they had food, they had music playing, they were playing board games, and I'm just laboring away and doing my thing, and, you know, and it was fine. I mean, I was enjoying the process too, you know, eating between contractions and participating. And I'd say the only really hard part got to be about the last half an hour, where they really picked up the pace. My water didn't break, so the nurse and the midwife came in and said, hey, how about we break your water for you? Speed this process up. So I let them do that. And as soon as they did that, they're like, well, you're ready to go. Let's do this. So
kind of caught me by surprise because I didn't, I wanted to mentally prepare. So, went into straight pushing mode, which, again, really wasn't prepared for quite yet. It wasn't how I envisioned it. I wanted to be like, okay, I'm ready. It's happening, and do the whole thing. Not like, oh, surprise, you're ready right now. Let's do this. But it took about 10 minutes. I'd say those 10 minutes, yeah, they're pretty painful. But that was it. And as soon as he was born, you know, again, same situation. And I remember the midwife and the nurses telling me that it was this nice, perfect pregnancy. Again, no painkillers or anything. Total improvement from the last time that I had a child. So it was like night and day. To the point where I was like, hey, I could do this again. It wasn't that bad. And I think it was just the mentality going into it, along with, you know, all those breathing exercises and the yoga and all that stuff and the walking.
And the doula really in me has to ask you, what was your position when you delivered?
What was my what?
What position were you in? Like, were you on your back or on your knees or on your, like, do you remember?
I was on my back, and that's why I was unprepared, because I did not want to deliver on my back. I mean, I was kind of in a half recline position, but because they had just broken the amniotic sac, you know, I had to be on my back to do that. And once they broke it, jumped all the way to 10 centimeters instantaneously and was ready to go. So that was not exactly how I wanted to give birth, but it worked out. I think it would have been a lot less painful had I been in another position, like more in a squatted position, but it was what it was, and it went relatively fast.
I'm curious. So this time, or the second time around, when you were at least in a relationship sense alone, do you remember which time did you feel more alone? The first time when you kind of had the ideal scenario in place, or the second time when it sounds like you also like had a great time both times, but I'm just curious if you remember the factor of aloneness. That's been a theme that a lot of women have talked about.
Yeah. The second time around, I definitely felt more connected and supported, just because it's interesting, because I was alone, so many more people were there and rallied around me, as opposed to the before. They're like, oh, well, she's got her partner, her husband. And he really didn't know what the heck he was doing. So I had to not only give birth, but also figure everything out as I went. So I'd say the first time around, I definitely felt a lot more alone than I did the second time. Yeah.
Okay. And the other thing that is interesting, I think there's so many interesting things, but you are a woman of color. You were adopted by a white woman and then later in life met your birth mother. Would you talk a little bit about what your family life has looked like and what it's meant for you to connect with your birth mother later in life and how you went about doing that and all of that good stuff?
Yeah. So I was adopted when I was 24 hours old by my mom, who culturally is white, even though she's half Asian. And my father, who is Mexican American. So, you know, I had a good childhood for the most part, very traditional, you know, stay at home mom, the father that worked. And I went to a religious family, private school for most of it. And then, kind of the neighborhood mom that made cookies for everyone, and people played at our house all the time. And, you know, that was just kind of who we were. But we were very untraditional. I mean, I was, you know, a mixed child of mixed ethnicity. At the time, I wasn't exactly sure what my ethnicity background was, but I knew I was at least, you know, African-American, Asian-American, and white-American, kind of all mixed together. My brother and sister were also adopted. My brother is full Filipino, and so my sister is half Filipino, half white. So, yeah, we were a very different family, but for the most part, people treated us normal because we acted in the traditional way that everybody else did, you know, the two-parent home, you know, the working dad and the stay-at-home mom.
And how do you get connected to your birth mother in later life? How old were you and how did you go about doing that?
So I met my birth mother about 8 months ago. And I took a 23andMe test, a DNA test. I got one for my birthday, which was in February, sent it in. And lo and behold, I discovered my father's whole side of the family that was on there. I discovered I had a sister and a niece and an aunt. And very quickly, I found him, and he gave me information about my mom. And I was able to look her up and contact her through her sister. And then we started talking, and I got to meet her, and she's African-American woman, raised in pretty much the Bay Area and has lived here her whole life. And she never married or had any children of her own. She was very young when she had me. So I've been connecting with her over the course of this past 8 months. Met her for the first time, I think it was in August. So we had communicated over the phone, but the first time I met her was in August.
August 2019.
And, yeah, 2019. And it's been an interesting journey getting to know her. You know, she's still very shy. And again, she's been very alone most of her life. Her mother passed away 3 years ago, and that was kind of her whole connection to people other than her sister, who she really didn't have much contact with after their mom passed away. So for me to come into her life with two kids was a huge, huge thing for her. Because again, she'd been really disconnected from family.
So what was that like? I'm just curious, like, what did you learn about your mother, and what has this done for you, too, in terms of understanding your context?
Yeah, I mean, it's still in the process. It's very new. I'm still kind of discovering that. But it was always something I wanted to do, eventually, you know, say thank you. Because she did two very hard things. She went through a pregnancy as a teenager, and then she gave up the child she really wanted so that I could have a really good life. Her family situation, the situation surrounding my birth, was not a positive one at all, and I would have had a very, very difficult life had she kept me. So very grateful for that. So it's nice to get to know her now. And include her into my family and with my children. So we're working on getting together on a regular basis, which is nice. And, you know, she's shy. So there's a lot that I still need to know. And she's a very private person. So most of what I've gotten to know about her is through my father's recollections, her sister, my sister. All of them are able to share with me more about her because she's still, you know, opening up. So, but she is more and more. I'm learning more about her. And there's things that we share a lot in common. Our love of nature, our love of just, you know, teaching and educating. I mean, she's worked with children. I love to work with children. And some of the same approaches I use are similar to what she does. So there's that connection. So for the first time, I have this genetic connection that I see myself in someone in that manner of speaking. So it's been a very exciting journey. And I think it's been a very cathartic one for her. So
that's awesome. And I had a question for you, but I got so into listening to your story that it just totally went away from me. Let me think if I can think of it. Oh, I know. So you said she didn't have any children of her own, but by that, do you mean that she didn't have any children that she raised, or were you the only child that she birthed?
I'm the only child she ever had. Yeah. She works as a professional nanny So she's raised and cared for many children, but she never had any of her own after me. I was her only child.
And you, it's like, I understand this could even be painful for you to talk about. Did she talk about what that was like, having been in a familial situation where she wasn't able to keep her own child, but then she, so she's not able to raise her own child, but she's raising other people's children. Did she ever share any of that about like what that was like with you, or have you ever had a chance to kind of speculate or imagine what that might
I'm
be like?
I'm speculating. And again, all of us are speculating, because she is at the point, she's kept everything in so long, she's never been able to put it to words. I actually just found out today that it's the first time she's ever put anything into words. She contacted my father today to give him a piece of her mind, which shows that for the first time in her life, she's processing her feelings, standing up for herself. And I know she's expressed to my aunt, her sister, and then my sister, how much she is just thrilled to be a mom and to have a daughter and to have grandchildren, and that she's, no one's gonna take that away. So, which will be an interesting step. I know she hasn't shared a lot with me yet, because it's still very new. We're still kind of strangers, and she's, again, a very shy, private person. But I can see the workings of that coming out, and I'm hoping, you know, as we get to know each other better, that I'll gain her confidence, and she'll feel more open to share. I know her sister's even commented that she's never shared some of these things before that she's sharing now. So that's really, she's really getting to know her in a different way too. So that's good.
When you did the 23andMe test, not only did you connect with your biological mother, but all kinds of biological relatives, even aunts, yes. And your whole world must have opened up in a way, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I have a sister, and she's really amazing, and we talk all the time. Visit each other. So that was amazing. I also had the sister I grew up with, the adopted sister. She and I had been estranged for 9 years, and she also found her biological family. And that was kind of me finding it around the same time she was, kind of what brought us back together. So I got the sister I was raised with back, which was really nice. And then, yeah, I mean, I have a niece who's amazing. I have a brother, too, who no one will tell that I exist yet. So he's still completely in the dark about it. Our father is very German. He's full German. Very traditional in the fact that culturally you don't talk about certain things. So that's been an interesting difference.
So he's German and also white, is that right?
Yeah, so he's a white American, but all German. So very German culture. Both sides, like all from the same area of Germany, around Munich, basically Bavarian German. And very stoic people. My dad is also on the spectrum, so, which has been interesting. And yeah, he's an interesting person. I like him, but again, he's a very interesting person.
The word interesting is convenient, right? It covers so many things.
It does. There's a lot that he misses. And a lot that he misses, because I think his brain is wired differently, but also because he is a well-to-do white male, well-educated, who is used to getting his way and used to being an authority and used to being in charge, and can't really put himself in the position of the women, especially the women of color that happen to be his wife, ex-wife, and children. So, yeah, It's something he's slowly learning, but he's older, and he's of that generation where it's challenging for him to change a way of doing things, a way of thinking for so long.
Wow.
Explaining how that actually, you know, makes us feel when he does, says, or behaves in a certain way. And I think it's also up to us to not just try to do the traditional, I'll protect him, that's just how he is, but to also lovingly educate, because I think that's the only way to change those attitudes, beliefs, you know, because he means well. It's just, yeah, it's hard for him to put himself in the place of a woman and a woman of color.
So, on another note, when your children interact with your biological mom and dad, do they call them grandma and grandpa, or where are they with this, and how do you explain the connection of both the adoptive parents and your biological ones to them?
Yeah, that's, I've always been very open with my children because my parents are very open with me. I always knew I was adopted. My children have always known I was adopted. You know, my daughter still... She's better now, but she used to be like, so when you were an orphan, I was like, well, it's a little different. I was never really quite an orphan. But when I found my biological parents, she already knew the backstory. She'd known that her whole life. And two, my father passed away when I was 21, so she'd never been raised with a grandfather on my side. Or, you know, I had my stepdad, but... You know, she never really was close to him at all. She called him by his first name anyway, because that's what everybody else called him. So she does call my dad Grandpa, because I think she always wanted me to have a dad. She always felt bad that I didn't. And her dad is very important to her. And when we talk about my mom, we call her Grandma and then by her first name, so Grandma Avadi. Versus Grandma Jennifer. And I think that one's a harder one for her to wrap her head around, because she doesn't understand how somebody can have two mothers at the same time, even though she understands the story. She's very close to my mother, my adoptive mother, because she spent so much time with her, and they have a lot in common. That being said, you know, our relationship hasn't always been the best. It's been on and off. My mom she's very different from me, and it's sometimes very hard with some of those differences. And so, you know, she knows that you know, sometimes on that side of the family, my mom can come and go. And so she's keeping definitely an open mind. She's been very warm to my biological mom. And, you know, she's a sweet kid. So.
And I imagine it will keep evolving, and you'll keep kind of meeting her where she's at and going through the process with both children, I imagine, if I know you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you had to think through actually, just one more logistical question. You talked about feeling like financially stable and all of these things, and there's moms like myself included who are way less financially stable, and they're embarking on this journey anyways. So I wondered if you could talk about kind of what does the day-to-day look like for you and your kids, and how do you make ends meet as an educator and a mom of two in the Bay Area?
Well, one nice thing is I have rent control. That does help. And I guess this is just, you know, always having money that I save. Basically, my grandma's philosophy, pay yourself first. And she taught me as a woman, my mother's, the one I was raised by, mother, how to just, you know, take care of yourself financially, because she was married and stayed at home because her husband wouldn't let her work. And when he passed away, she inherited all of these financial problems and had to rebuild so that she could take care of herself for the rest of her life, which she, you know, lived a very long life after my grandfather passed away, 30 years. So I learned a lot from her about, you know, where, how, all the different things of to take care of your money, but still be able to, you know, enjoy life and how to make money on the side and how to make your money grow when you do have it. You know, I use connections. I have a really good person that takes care of my son and also took care of my daughter. And that really saved me on time and, of course, childcare. You know, I never had any debt. I paid it all off before I had kids, which was just happened to be lucky that I took care of it right away. Like all my college debt, had it paid off. My car, had that paid off. So that I could just save every single month and always find a way, even if it was a little amount, just always paying myself first. And, you know, really cutting back on things I didn't need, like clothing, for example. I've always bought, you know, buy, sell, trade stuff. And don't buy it very often. Just, you know, it's the little things cut. Never, ever, you know, got coffee or lattes. I used to when I was young until I realized how much I was spending. So I just looked at everything that I was buying and spending and really made some changes and cut back. And especially the second time around, my kids, when it came to toys, I mean, I'd get toys from other family members or friends that were giving them away. So I never really had to worry about that. Diapers, I just always buy them when they're on sale in bulk. I've only bought diapers twice in my son's life because I got them in bulk for a ridiculously cheap price. And, you know, I think I spent a total of $200 on diapers for this whole, for his whole life so far, which, you know, I just look for different ways to save.
Resourcefulness.
Resourceful, yeah, just yes. Being resourceful, just always being resourceful and, you know, taking advantage of opportunities when they come up. And that's it. And I think I would do that anyway, regardless if I had kids or not, but kids do force me to do it more often. So I actually am more stable now than I was when I was single and didn't have childcare expenses or all those other expenses. So, yeah.
Okay. And earlier you mentioned, you said, having kids is the best thing that you've ever done, and you've done some really cool things. And I mean, I know because I found you and became your friend when we were both on the other side of the world, and life mm-hmm. looked very different then. I wondered if you could reflect on, you know, what life looked like before that and what it's been like for you in the past decade since you've introduced kids into your world. And reflect on what's the most important lesson that you've learned on this whole journey.
I have learned two very important lessons. One is how to let go, and two is how to embrace the now and find gratitude and joy in what I have currently. And that was definitely something I did not have before. I was not capable of letting things go. I, you know, if things didn't work out, I just would lose endless hours, days, months on how could I have done this better? How could I, you know, or this shouldn't have happened. This wasn't supposed to happen that way. Or, and missing the now, you know, always thinking ahead to the future. Oh, when this happens, I'll be happier. Or when this, if I get this, then I'll be happier. If this happens, and just really embracing what's happening right now and finding joy and gratitude in that and practicing that gratitude of, okay, you know, maybe I had a horrible day, but I'm healthy. My kids are healthy. We have food. We have a roof over our head. We're doing great. Traveling, you know, that gives you so much perspective because I've been in so many places around the world and met so many different people that are so happy that have so little, you know, And just witnessing their generosity of spirit and their way of just embracing, you know, life. I think living in really difficult conditions or poverty-like conditions does force that upon you. You have to learn to let the things go. I think in our kind of Western lifestyle, you know, we have so much that those little realizations took me so long to get to, as opposed to all these people that I met in these places that just had that, yet they had really none of the material possessions that we, you know, gauge our success by here. So, yeah, by far, those are the two most powerful lessons. Plus, and I learned a heck of a lot of patience, but granted, I teach kids, so in high school.
Talk about patience, because that's a biggie. And then I was going to ask you, how like these lessons were amplified by motherhood, but don't forget to talk about patience, because nobody has enough of that.
No one does have enough patience. You know, having children just live in the now, and they're capable of such huge levels of forgiveness, and the way they see the world so simply, you can't help but want to be more like that, because it's just so innocent and beautiful. And that's what I see in my kids all the time. You know, I'm the one who will mess up. Like, I'll get frustrated when we're not getting out of the house in the morning, and, you know, just like, oh, I'm all crazy. And then, you know, they'll just, you know, turn to me, give me hugs as if nothing was wrong. They won't take it personally. And they're like, I'm sorry, Mom. I hope you feel better today. And that says, and then I realize, okay, wait a second. It doesn't need to be. I'm so lucky to have these two, because they teach me all the time about patience and forgiveness and letting go and embracing the now and finding joy in that.